We're going to begin by talking about an issue that we have discussed a number of times here on this show that is very much in the conversation locally, statewide, and nationally, the issue of race and policing, specifically the issue of racial disparities when it comes to policing, as far down to the level of traffic stops. This is, again, part of the national conversation, has been for a very long time. What are the numbers? What are the trends, and what can we learn about progress in the future? Frank Baumgartner is a professor of political science at UNC. He's been studying this issue for a long time. He just published last month a new book with Derek Epp and Kelsey Schaub called Suspect Citizens, What 20 Million Traffic Stops Tell Us About Policing and Race. Took a look at data going all the way back to 2002 from North Carolina and other jurisdictions around the country. He joins us here now in the studio. Dr. Baumgartner, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Aaron.
So tell us what you found. This is not your first project dealing with this issue. So what specifically were you looking for in this particular study, and what were the results?
Well, North Carolina was the first state in the nation to mandate collecting traffic stops data on every traffic stop, and that was back in 1999. And the law applied only to the highway patrol at first, but in 2002 it was expanded to every police department in the state. And so we've got a database now that's been collected by the state, by every agency. After every traffic stop, we know who got pulled over, their age, race, and gender, why they were pulled over, and then what happened. So it's the interesting thing is, not only were we the first state in the nation to mandate collecting the data, but the law also mandated that there should be periodic reports from the Attorney General's office, and there's never been a report. So when we found that out, we said, you know what, we need to look at this entire database and write a comprehensive report. And so that's what we did. It took quite a long time. We've been working on it for about 7 years.
Wow. I want to ask why North Carolina was the one who became the first state. What happened in 1999? But the real question is, why did it take that long, and why didn't the other 49 states do something, right?
Driving while black, I think, has been an issue in the black and driving while brown in the brown community for quite a long time. It surged to attention. There was a lot of media attention in the late 1990s about the topic, and North Carolina has a large legislative black caucus. Mm-hmm. And so members of the black caucus mobilized. And also, I should say, there was some investigative reporting by the Raleigh News and Observer journalist Joe Neff, who wrote an investigative report about a particular drug interdiction team in the State Highway Patrol, and documented that they were searching black drivers at about twice the rate that they were searching whites. And when that was published, the Highway Patrol, of course, was upset with that adverse news coverage. But it got the attention of the legislators in Raleigh, and they mandated this database collection.
So this book that just got published is a look at all of that data, taking a look at who gets stopped, who gets searched after they get stopped, what gets found during a search, and do people get a ticket, do people get a warning, do people get let off? What were the disparities, or what were the results of the study?
Well, I can be really simple on that. I don't want to bore the listeners with too many numbers, but black drivers are much more likely to be pulled over. Mm-hmm. The rate at which a black North Carolinian would be pulled over in a traffic stop is about twice that of a white driver. And then once pulled over, the rate that they might be searched is over twice the rate of a white driver. And now we've looked at everything that we could use in the database. What time of day it was, why did they get pulled over, was it a speeding violation or drunk driving or an equipment malfunction, what day of the week it was, what agency, whether they were pulled over by a particular officer who has a racially disparate pattern in his own traffic stops, and none of these things could explain away the very significant race effect. And so race, gender, age, time of day, those are all important factors. But race by itself, and in particular being a young man of color, that's the target for searches and traffic stops.
And you mentioned there, you looked at individual officers and if there are racial disparities there. That, I think, is the argument that people always kind of come back to when they're pushing against findings like this as well. You can single out individual bad apples and say, well, it's all on them, but it's not all on them.
Well, we identified statistically what are referred to as bad apples, and we also use that phrase. And we defined a bad apple officer as an officer that has higher than the average search rate for his agency or hers, and more than a 2-to-1 disparity in their search rates of black and white drivers. And there are a number of such officers in the state. As a matter of fact, about a third of all officers qualify as having more than a 2-to-1 search rate disparity, because the overall statewide search rate is 2-to-1. So that's the average. So it's quite high, and it's ubiquitous, and it's not driven just by a few rogue officers by any means. There's a lot of officers with high disparities, and there's entire agencies that have pretty high disparities. So it's quite a widespread thing. The other thing that I want to mention is that these searches don't very often lead to significant contraband fines. The typical search is unsuccessful. About 70% lead to nothing at all. We call those a fruitless search. And I think that legally speaking, police officers and members of the public have always thought that there is no cost to these fruitless searches. And the Supreme Court has ruled that there is no price to pay for such a thing. There's no penalty to the police for doing a fruitless search. We can't expect the police to be perfect in their predictive powers. But what we want to add to the conversation is that each time we do a fruitless search and we subject an individual to an investigation that proves to be unwarranted, we tear just a little bit at the fabric of our democracy. We make that person a little bit antagonistic towards the police if it was truly a pretextual traffic stop. Now, the court has never ruled in this direction whatsoever, because the court considers people who look like me. That is a white, middle-class college professor. For me, it really would be consistent with the court's rulings that these are just trivial inconveniences, a momentary inconvenience. And I haven't been stopped by police officers very often in my life, and I've never been searched following a traffic stop, so I don't fit the profile. But for those young men of color who do fit the profile, it's not a momentary inconvenience. It might take an hour or longer, they might be late to work, and it might happen once a month. And if that's the way you have to go through your life, then naturally you would have a very hard time having a good deal of respect for the police, because you might be angry.
Yeah, and I know I've never been searched. I've been stopped a couple of times, and just like you, it's a mild inconvenience for me, but it's humiliating when you're sitting on the side of the road, people are driving past you, you have that experience of, what did I do? People are looking at me, I've done something wrong. Whether you've done something wrong or not, it might be just a routine traffic stop and you get let off with not even a warning, but that kind of shame and humiliation, even before that contributes to negative feelings toward the police or toward government or institutions in general, that alone is really significant.
It turns out that, I mean, I have done interviews with people, a member of the Texas House of Representatives who was Latino was describing his own experience being searched on the grounds of his own high school.
Mm-hmm.
And he was made to sit on the ground in handcuffs in front of the teachers and his friends walking by as the police searched his car fruitlessly.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just suspected that it was too nice a car for such a man to have. And so, of course, he didn't forget that, and he sponsored legislation to mandate an end to racial profiling in Texas.
So speaking with Frank Baumgartner again, the author of Suspect, co-author of Suspect Citizens, What 20 Million Traffic Stops Tell Us About Policing and Race, just published last month. We're only going to be able to talk for 10 minutes or so, but if you want more, you can head to the Chapel Hill Public Library Monday evening, 6:30 to 8 p.m. for a discussion about race and policing with Dr. Baumgartner that's sponsored by Chapel Hill's Justice and Action Committee. So getting back to kind of the prominent statistic here, and tell me if I'm wrong, just kind of extrapolating from what you said, if you, all else being equal, if you are black and you get behind the wheel of the car, you are 4 times more likely to wind up having your car searched by an officer than if you are white, right?
That's right. Four times.
So what can be done about that?
Well, there's a couple things that are quite simple. The first is for the police to question whether it's really worth it to use the traffic code and the vehicle code as an opportunity to investigate whomever the police feel like maybe should be investigated based on a hunch or based on their appearance. And perhaps we should go back to using or go to a system where we use the traffic code just to keep the road safe.
Mm-hmm.
And if the police could really be introspective and really look at the numbers, from what I've seen, they would find that the use of the traffic code as an excuse or a pretext to investigate people for possible involvement in crime is really a needle in the haystack process where you have to stop maybe 1,000 people before you find your drug courier, so to speak, or whatever, someone involved in something seriously illegal. And I'm not talking about just a little bit of residue of a teeny bit of marijuana that might be in a car that is often what we find when there's a contraband hit. It's a very small amount of contraband. But how many times do we find really significant amounts? It's very, very rare. Old-fashioned police investigatory techniques would be much better use of everybody's time. And then if the police focused on just keeping the road safe, that is stopping people for speeding, stopping people for drunk driving, texting while driving, and seriously dangerous driving practices, then everyone would be safer. Also, members of the minority community wouldn't feel that they were being unfairly targeted. There'd be fewer fruitless searches. There would be fewer searches. And yes, there probably would be fewer contraband hits, but when you look at the contraband hits that result from traffic stops, typically they're not very large criminal enterprises that are being interdicted. It's just somebody with a little bit of marijuana.
You've been studying this for years, and I want to ask about trends. We can look at data now for more than a decade. Is this a problem that's getting better? Is it getting worse? Is it not changing at all?
The racial disparity is actually getting worse.
Hmm.
I think the search rates have been going down, but they're quite erratic. I've been surprised by so many things in this research. One is the variability from officer to officer is huge. Certain officers will search 30 and 40% of all the drivers they encounter. The average statewide is just 3%. And many officers have never searched anybody, as far as we can tell, in their entire careers.
Mm.
So that was surprising. Another thing was surprising is from city to city, from agency to agency, the rate of search differs dramatically. It can be as high as 10% in Charlotte, and in Winston-Salem, it's 1.5%. And in the State Highway Patrol, it's 0.6%. And then for the same city, it can differ, it can be twice as high in one year as in the next year. It can go up and down quite dramatically. And so that tells me that all of these things are within the control of police leaders to decide whether to ratchet up or ratchet down the aggressiveness of their police officers and traffic stops. And so I think it is within their control.
I think that's really significant because, I mean, there's a lot of numbers there, but just the idea of due process and the idea of the rule of law, right, suggests that policing and the criminal justice system in general not be arbitrary. Someone does the exact same thing 100 times, you should get treated the exact same way 100 times. And if there's that big of a disparity, that's huge just in and of itself.
It's huge, but I want to explain something that most listeners might not even understand, but police officers would say, well, I have the right to stop you and investigate you mm-hmm. if you break a law. And that, of course, makes sense. But everybody's breaking the traffic laws almost at all times, especially when you consider the discretion that an officer has to say, if you're driving too slow, you're obstructing traffic. If you're driving too fast, obviously you're speeding. And the Supreme Court has ruled that if you break a law, even a traffic law, you are open to a police investigation. Further, they've said that the police investigations don't have to be fair or equitable. The police can pick and choose. And so the police can use their discretion to find people who've broken a law, even by touching the yellow line or swerving just ever so slightly or not having their seatbelt on or driving 49 miles an hour in a 55 zone because they could say that that's obstructing traffic, even if there's no other cars around. So the traffic code and the vehicle code, having a crack in your taillight or a dangling mirror, all those things provide an opportunity for a police officer at his discretion to have a conversation. And since those conversations typically don't take place with middle-class white Americans who vote, they are concentrated on people who, for whatever reason, attract the suspicion of the officer, and that's concentrated on young men of color.
So starting to wrap up here, that seems to suggest that in the absence of kind of court orders, the police have to police themselves, or elected officials have to police the police.
One
right?
of the perhaps the most surprising results that we had was that we did an entire chapter on this. The higher the percent of blacks in positions of political power in the community, the lower the disparities. Hmm. So if there's more blacks who vote, there's more blacks who live in the community, and there's more blacks who are on the city council, racial disparities in the policing and even in traffic stops is reduced. And so I think that does mean we get the police departments that we want. Every community chooses how they want their police department to behave, and we see it systematically in the data.
Speaking with Frank Baumgartner, we do have to wrap up. Final thoughts, what is, if there's one thing that you want people to take away from this research, what do you want it to be?
I can't say exactly why these disparities have occurred, and we don't in the book try to explain or try to put our finger on a single explanation of these disparities, but I think the conversation has to go away from are there disparities to recognizing that white and black Americans and white and Latino, brown Americans experience dramatically different things when they interact with the police. And that has been largely invisible to most middle-class whites who can't imagine that the police would be anything other than respectful and justified in their behaviors. But we've created an empathy gap where white Americans can't understand the reactions that some minority community members have, which is based on a mistrust that white Americans really can't empathize with because it's not happening to us.
The book is Suspect Citizens. It's out now. If you want more information, you can check out the book online. Also, head to the Chapel Hill Public Library Monday the 13th next week from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for a conversation with Dr. Baumgartner, sponsored by Chapel Hill's Justice in Action Committee. Frank Baumgartner, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.